was also my service sponsor, so he's one of the people that I don't say no to. That can be very dangerous. Okay. I get a little organized here. Just in case of disaster, I printed my slides. Plan C is not needed. That's good. My name is J.M., and I am an alcoholic. I had my last drink on July 25th, 1982. I went to my first meeting on January 18th, 1982, so it took me a little bit of time. But at that first meeting, a gentleman by the name of Ray H. came up and appointed himself my sponsor. Ray had gotten sober in 1948. He had been the youngest full partner in the Arthur Anderson accounting firm at 25 years old. 7 years later, he's living on the streets of Chicago. And the last friend he had in the world came and got him, brought him back to Ohio, and Sister Ignatia got him sober. And he told me she did it by never mentioning his drinking. She attacked his ego and destroyed his ego, and then the AA boys could talk to him, and he was willing to listen. So I was one of the ones who knew the ones. He used to tell me that he didn't know Dr. Bob, but he shook the man's hand once, and he was proud of that. And as we go through time, we're all the ones who knew the ones who knew the ones who knew the ones, and we're getting farther and farther and farther away from them, which is why it's so important what we all do. The first 16 years that I was sober, I was home group, serve the home group, do 12-step calls. I found out later that Ray had talked to the Cleveland Central office, and any call coming in from Solon or Aurora went to him first. And we went on dozens of 12-step calls. Dozens. First one I ever went on was at 2 o'clock in the morning. We went to a guy's house. All the lights are off. I figure the guy chickened out and took off. Ray says, nah, he's in there. He made me walk around the house and find an open window. I crawled in over the sink in the kitchen, and we found this poor guy huddled in the corner in the library watching the elephants crossing the ceiling. And Ray carried a pint of bourbon with him in his trunk. And we got a couple of shots in this boy and got him to the VA. And I have no idea if he's sober today, but I am. In 98, I moved to Akron, and one of those providential things, the first meeting I ever went to was called the Pass It On meeting on a Saturday night. They were reading out of Language of the Heart, and the topic that night was the Rockefeller Dinner. And I knew a little bit about the Rockefellers. In high school, I had written a large paper with a theme that Standard Oil was a benign monopoly because they didn't price gouge. They controlled 90% of the market, but they didn't price gouge. And Gail talked to me afterwards, invited me down to the archives, and I was there pretty much every Saturday for the next 15 years. And she pretty much taught me everything I knew. I knew nothing about General Service. I knew we had an office in New York, and that was about it. I knew nothing about areas or DCMs or districts or areas, nothing. If I can summarize what Gail taught me over 15 years, it's in one sentence. It's very simple. Everything we ever looked at, she asks basically three questions. Does it follow the traditions? Does it follow the concepts? Is it ethical? And if the answers weren't yes, 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 we didn't do it. And she applied that to everything, and that's what she taught me. Then our panel's 32 delegate, Joan A., performed some spiritual trickery. And she asked me one day if I could drive her to a meeting on Sunday. And despite the fact that the Browns were on, I said yes, because I was taught if an old-timer asks you to do something, you do it. Well, the meeting she took me to was the Area 54 Assembly. And I'd never seen anything like it. They argued for 40 minutes over 25 bucks. It was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. And I was hooked. From that point on, I served in a bunch of different capacities in the area. I've been the archives chair, I've been the Area 54 archivist, and the area chairman, and it's been a joy. And one of the things that I love about service and conventions like this is every single person in this room loves Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's not true with every room we go to. I want to thank the committee for asking me. Oh, and one last thing. I now reside in New Mexico. I have my compatriots here from Area 46. My boss asked me to move for work, and I immediately said no. And then I talked to my sponsor about it. He said, oh, you made a major decision without talking to me first, eh? And he posed a question that was sort of interesting. He said, what if the only reason that you're sober is because God wants you to run into somebody who happens to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and you're not going to move, huh? So I listened to my sponsor and I moved, and it was a great thing. I love New Mexico. It's fabulous. The weather is spectacular. I want to thank Bob for asking me and the committee. It made me get off my butt and get this thing finished. I'm going to talk a little bit about the researching and the writing process and what I did to put this thing together. The committee asked me to, and then I'm going to cover three different things. The $5,000 donation, the dinner and the buyout of the big book, and something that happened with the Manhattan Group. Sometime in the year 2000, I went to Denver to the Society of American Archivists convention. And I guess because of that, I got on the Rockefeller Archives mailing list, and I got this newsletter in 2000. And the story that Bob told there tells us about memory. It's not really true. I get this thing, and I wonder if they have anything on AA, and send them an email. And a few days later, I get an email back that they have four folders. And in Rockefeller Archive parlance, a folder can be anything to a folder to 12 square feet of shelf space. It depends. And there was a finding aid list of everything that was in these four folders, and the amount of history that was in there was stunning that we just had never seen before. And I had also read Fosdick's biography of John D. Rockefeller Jr., and AA was not even given a sentence. And there was some extensive writing in there on the Rockefellers and temperance and prohibition and their interest in alcohol, and AA never even drew a mention. So I'm lamenting this to Gail. And she says, well, why don't you write a book about it? And it's one of those things that just sort of stops you in your tracks. And I said, okay. And I made some starting assumptions. I was writing for two audiences. I was writing for people who might be interested in Rockefeller and know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous or Bill or Bob, and writing for us who know everything about Alcoholics Anonymous but might not know much about Rockefeller. I'm not going to get into a lot with him, but let me give you an idea of how much money they had. In 1929, the New York Tribune ran a daily chart of the Rockefeller wealth. It was the equivalent of 2% of the gross domestic product. In today's money, that's $380 billion. If you invest that at 2% interest, you would have to spend $580 million a month to spend the interest. It's a mind-boggling amount of money. I also agree with Ernie that AA doesn't start in any time other than the Great Depression. I think he's absolutely right. So the first chapter that I wrote, and that's going to be hard to read, but that's the chapters, was on the market crash and the Depression and the end of Prohibition. The other thing that happened during that period was we changed from a temperance paradigm to an alcoholism paradigm, and it was vital for our survival because the temperance paradigm was that it was immoral to drink, nobody should drink, and it shifted over to some people can, some people can't. And I alternated chapters on Bill and Bob, and then Rockefeller, and Bill and Bob, and then Rockefeller until the two of them meet, and then it goes forward from there. All three of them were remarkable men. One of the things I wish people would not do is call Bill a stockbroker. He was not a stockbroker. He was a stock analyst. And there's a difference. You know that when he and Lois went out on that motorcycle trip, He was the first person that ever went out in the field to investigate a company. Nobody had ever done that before. He was ridiculed for it, and it was revolutionary. Bob was as remarkable a man, as was Rockefeller. I grew up in a pretty wealthy, with a father that was fairly powerful. So I have an inkling of what it's like to grow up under a father like that. And his story, he had two mental breakdowns before he was 15 years old, trying to emulate his father until he finally found his own way. And essentially what he did, because his father was hated, what he did was work to give all that money away and rescue the family name. When I started doing the research, I'll go through these, they're too hard to read to even go through them. When I first started doing the research, I knew about the 5,000, I knew about the dinner, I knew that there were some associates that helped a little bit, and that's really all I knew. The length and depth of the true story is stunning. It started in 1937 with the initial 5,000. The formation of the Alcoholic Foundation, that the initial board was Chip and Amos Richardson, who were all Rockefeller associates, three AAs, including Dr. Bob, and Dr. Strong, Bill's brother-in-law, was the tiebreaker. And that remained that way for a while, that Leonard Strong was the tiebreaker. The Rockefeller dinner, the Works Publishing buyback, the Manhattan Group that I'll talk about, the battle over the trustee ratio and the conference. I have a whole chapter on it. You could write an entire book on it. And it was Bill and Leonard Harrison, who was the chairman of the board. And Bill wrote some things that you'd read them and go, did Bill wrote that? And Harrison really toned him down. And it's a whole story in itself. Rockefeller provided a tremendous amount of help to the AA seamen in New York. And Bill and Frank Amos became very good friends, and there was extensive correspondence between Bill and Mary Amos for years and years and years, including talking about some of the spook sessions she had. Mary would write letters saying she talked to Bob last night, and he's doing fine, and Annie is great, and she wanted to know how Billy's doing. And that's another book in and of itself, is the spook sessions they all had. And finally, the influence of all the associates, Chipman, Richardson, Amos, Scott, Harrison, Woods, plus some others. The most important was Willard Richardson. He was Rockefeller's main spiritual advisor concerning his private charities. He'd known him since Brown University. They went to Brown together and took a bike tour through Europe together. They were very good friends. Frank Amos. He was an advertising man, a newspaper owner. He owned the Daily Jeffersonian in Ohio, which is still being published. A longtime friend of Rockefeller's. And he did a number of private investigations for Rockefeller. There's some of the files that he's involved with are closed, which is sort of interesting. Leroy Chipman on the left was responsible for Rockefeller's real estate and treasurer of certain Rockefeller charities. Albert Scott, who was the engineer and executive of Lockwood Green, chairman of the board of the trustees of Riverside Church. He co-authored Rockefeller's Toward Liquor Control and was part of his board. One of the things I asked the Rockefeller Archives was if they had any material on the various associates. They had one little skinny folder on Scott, and there was a cover letter that he wrote Rockefeller saying, you know, you got to stop paying me this $500 a month. I don't feel like I'm doing anything for it. And a follow-up letter from Rockefeller saying, I really value our relationship, but I'll cut it to $250. No evidence of what he was doing for the money. And $500 a month, I mean, $6,000 a year, you could buy a house for that. This was not a small amount of money. So there's these two letters, and then I turned the next letter over. And I had been looking for a picture of Scott for a long time. Can't find it. I called Lockwood Green. They're still in business, or at least they were 10 years ago. His picture wasn't in any of the annual reports they had. I turned the letter over, and here's this newsletter article with Scott's picture, and I'm sitting in the nice, quiet, dignified Rockefeller Archives to go, there is a God, and pound the table. And look up and say, did I say that out loud? And all these people are looking at me. There's like 10 people in there. And I said, I've been looking for this for a long time. And they all just clapped and went back to their work. Leonard Harrison, he was a sociologist. He was the director of the Community Service Society of New York, which is sort of the United Way of its day. He was a member of Rockefeller's Liquor Study Group and co-author of After Repeal. Dr. Fosdick, head pastor of Riverside Church. And then John Wood, who helped with the foundation, drawing up the foundation papers, William West, and Dr. Kennedy. When I started, I had absolutely no idea how to do this. I found, so being the obsessive alcoholic I am, I researched doing research and found a William Cronin. It's hard to see. It's www.williamcronin.net. It is a wealth of information on researching and how to do it and how to look at documents and how to go through libraries and just all kinds of great stuff. And he says the goal of historical research isn't to gather documents and collect information. These are raw materials of history, not history itself. And your real goal is to build an argument and tell a story. What happened? Why? What were the consequences? And why should we care? This is interesting. Paradoxical though it may sound, one of the most challenging things about doing historical research is that the past doesn't exist anymore. Seems obvious. And historians use the word documents, and Ernie talked about that last night, that it can be a book, a newspaper, but it can be anything else with a trace of the past, a photograph, a map, an artifact, a memory, a landscape, almost anything. You're not the first person to research this. So go through what people have done before. Read what people have done before. And that's where I started. I read everything I could get my hands on, starting with AAWS material, then went to My Name is Bill W. and Grateful to Have Been There, and everything that was written on it. This was really important. We really rarely know what to think about a subject until we try to write about it. It means drafting and revising are deeper parts of the research process than we typically recognize. By starting to write while you're still in the process of gathering documents, you will find yourself discovering that you need additional things that you hadn't recognized. So because of that, I wrote a first draft before I went to New York. And it pointed out the holes. It pointed out what I needed to know. It pointed out what I hadn't found yet. That's very hard to see. But what I did was I went through each book. I would write down like a one-sentence synopsis of something I found that would fit in the book. I'd put the page number and I'd give it assigned it a number. I have 27 legal pads, just like that page. Once I did that, then I put together an outline. Again, that's too hard to see. But I put together the outline of each chapter, and I took all those subject notes and put them in with each thing so we could get everything together. And I saved Not God for last. Reading the footnotes in God, Not God, is as good as reading the book. 80% of the list I put together for the Trustees Archive Committee of what I wanted to see came out of Ernie's footnotes. They're brilliant. Took 2 years, wrote the first draft, and left for New York. Started at the Rockefeller Archives, just a cheap little place. That's on it's in Tarrytown, right outside Manhattan, sitting on 100 acres. It's gorgeous. They told me that the place is built so their main vault can withstand a direct nuclear strike. New York may be gone, but the Rockefeller Archives will still be there. Oh. Before you ask, yes, I've asked if they had any first edition sitting in boxes that didn't get sent out with the letter after the dinner, and no, they don't. I also found a letter Bill wrote to Rockefeller where he inscribed a first edition, first printing of AA Comes of Age, and no, they don't have that either. I asked. As it turns out, I could have done Rockefeller in a day and saved 3 days for GSO. Because Rockefeller will make you copies. And what they do is when you start, they give you these blue cards. And if there's something, as you're going through the folders, if there's something you want, you write down all the details of what it is, you hang it on the piece of paper, you leave it in the folder. When you're done, you give it back to the archivist. They go through it, count the cards, you write them a check, and about a month or so later, everything arrives in the mail. So one of the skills I learned in high school was to speed read. I can read, if I don't have to comprehend for a long time, I can read 1,500 words a minute. It came in really handy here. So I didn't have to really read everything except to go deep enough to know that I wanted it. Then I went to GSO, where they won't make copies, and I understand why. It's an anonymous organization. I completely support the policy, but it means that you got to write really fast. And by the way, the Intertruth Center, where the GSO offices are located, has a strong connection with Rockefeller through the Sea Atlantic Fund. He donated the land the building sits on, gave $2 million towards the building fund, and also paid for the exterior limestone. So I spent 2 days in the GSO archives. Michelle, Amy was the archivist at that time, and Michelle was unfortunately assigned to my case. I sent in a 4-page list to the Trustees Archives Committee of what I wanted to see. They approved my coming in. She put together every single item except one that they didn't have on that list. I asked as a throwaway to see the foundation books, and she gave them to me. I think it's probably because of my general service background. They figured it wasn't going to get thrown on the internet. But I just want to say I fully am aware how hard you worked for me, and thank you. This work and this book does not exist without her. Then I went to Stepping Stones. That's when I had more hair and less stomach. They didn't have a whole lot there, but they had a series of letters between Bill and Richardson setting up the initial meeting. And then they had all the correspondence between the Amoses and Bill at the end. So 14 years and 4,000 to 5,000 hours later, here I stand. I didn't really write a book. I wrote 12 stories that became 12 chapters that became a book. When I came home, I finished the draft, and then I had to get permission to quote from all this stuff, and got permission from the Rockefeller Archives. I got permission to produce two of the letters, and I sent all the pages that quoted anything from AAWS to New York to Darlene Smith, who then sent back pages that looked like that. It took her a couple of months, and I was stunned at how deeply they went into it and put notes and said it should be this word and not that word. She made suggestions. I changed everything that she wanted changed. And then got permission. So I'm going to focus on three things tonight. As I said, the initial $5,000 contribution and the myths and legends surrounding it. Rockefeller dinner, the monies raised, and the buyback of the big book, and a little-known New York intergroup attempt to purchase a new headquarters. Now, we all know the story. Bill and Bob sit down in late 1937, and they count noses, and there's about 40 people sober, and they're really grateful, and they say, this thing works. Meetings were held in New York and Akron, And they passed, barely in Akron, passed doing missionaries, hospitals, and a book. But they're going to need money. Bill hit up everybody. He knew every Wall Street contact. He knew all the people. He knew he couldn't raise anything. Then Leonard Strong, Bill's brother-in-law, remembered a man named Willard Richardson who had something to do with Rockefeller. Leonard called him. Bill and Richardson met. And a meeting was held in Rockefeller's boardroom, and Bill sat in the chair just vacated by the great man. Attending that meeting were Albert Scott, Willard Richardson, A. Leroy Chipman, Frank Amos, Dr. Silkworth, Leonard Strong. Alcoholics were Bill and Bob, Hank P., Bill R., Ned P., Joe T., Fitz M., and Paul S. They told their stories, and Albert Scott exclaimed, "This is first century Christianity. What can we do to help?" Bill probably thought, "Well, you can whip out your checkbook." AA Comes of Age also states, Scott asked, "Won't money spoil this thing?" We know they kicked some things around, and they know that they decided that at least Dr. Bob needed some help. Frank Amos travels to Akron, investigates us, writes a glowing report that he turns into Rockefeller, recommending that Rockefeller give $50,000. Rockefeller, now remember, this is Depression 1937 money. Rockefeller, feeling strangely stirred by all this, but deciding money would spoil this, only gives $5,000. From the $5,000, $3,000 goes to Dr. Bob immediately to pay off his mortgage, and Bill and Bob get $30 a week to keep him alive. The only problem with this is it's just not true. In November of 37, Richardson writes a letter to Strong. It states, "Now I've had conferences with four men whose judgment as to the interesting story of Mr. Wilson I think is good. They were all inclined to agree with me that if possible, any organization of this project and anything that tended to professionalize or institutionalize it would be a serious matter and quite undesirable." What's interesting about this is Richardson's obviously not talking about himself. We got Scott, Chipman, and Amos. Who's the fourth guy? I have no idea. Amos did travel to Akron, but not completely on his own dime. There's a letter in the Rockefeller archives detailing that Chipman, Richardson, and Scott funded the trip. Amos returned and prepared the Amos report and the original typed reports in the Rockefeller archives and sent it to Richardson with a cover letter suggesting $10,000 donation. He also looked at a couple of sites for a clinic. Contrary to our history, the report did not go directly to Rockefeller. So was Amos ready to recommend $50,000? Henrietta suggests that she talked him out of it when they were in Akron. Or did he return to New York ready to ask for that amount and Richardson talked him out of it, knowing Rockefeller wasn't going to give that much? I believe, and I have absolutely no evidence whatsoever to prove this, but I believe that that's the number Bill had in his mind to do missionaries and hospitals and a book. But that figure never saw Rockefeller. Fortunately, and what a great thing for archivists, is starting with a senior Rockefeller, it had been the practice of them to write a memo or a letter summarizing any meeting or phone call. So there are memo after memo after memo after memo describing what happened. Letters from the Rockefeller archives show that Frank Amos wrote a cover letter and he recommended $10,000. And in a letter written February 23rd, 1938, Richardson writes his proposal to Rockefeller. He starts out the letter saying, "You may recall my saying to you a few words about a group of men and women who have been saved from the worst forms of alcoholism by real religious experience." So one of the legends is Rockefeller was interested in the movement right from the December 37 meeting, and the fact is, in reading the letters, show that he knew almost nothing about it prior to February 38. When Rockefeller would reply to the Richardson memo in March, He stated, quote, in regard to the work for drunk addicts, which you and a few of your friends have been interested in. He didn't say that we have been interested in. A few words about a group of men who have been saved from the worst form. The impression is the importance and experience of activity grows upon us. And that's written by Richardson. Saying a few words precludes any long meeting with Rockefeller. Amos is the only person to investigate AA. That is simply not true. If you're reading the letters, it states there is an abundance of material in the form of information we've received, which we will be glad to give you. The Amos report was attached to the letter, so it had to be other information. It's not in the Rockefeller archives. I don't know what it is, but obviously they did something. My guess is they interviewed some of the people in New York and talked to some of the people in New York. Legend that Frank Amos met with Rockefeller. Never met with him alone, at least not on this. Again, back to the 50,000 or 30,000, depending on which of our literature we look at. Amos recommended 10, and Rockefeller never saw the 50,000. He did approve 5. The Rockefeller return letter states your interest in the work. So again, it's not my interest in the work, our interest in the work. It's your interest in the work. Pass It On claims quite incorrectly that Amos recommended a total of $50,000. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers makes the same claim. And again, I think it was Bill's original idea. It just never saw Rockefeller's desk. And again, he says, I do not wonder at your interest in the work. The great legend that he turned down the money because he believed the money would spoil the movement. The fact is that he turned down the money because of his giving policy, not because of any being stirred by AA. He states in the letter, while I would like to do what you gentlemen want me to do, as you know, it is contrary to our office policy to undertake the entire responsibility for any enterprise. And he made the donation really because Richardson and Chipman and the rest of them recommended it, not because he was greatly interested in our work. Now this, of course, would change. Again, he doesn't talk about my interest or our interest. He gives the money to the fund of for the Riverside Church. He also states in the end, you will not look to me for a further contribution for this object. So the end of the letter is, don't come back for more money. He will change his mind, but at the time it was, this is it. Don't come back for more money. Rockefeller writes a check for $5,000. Dr. Bob's mortgage is paid off, and the balance is distributed to Wilson and Smith. The fact is, he pledges $5,000. When he sends back his letter, there's a check attached to it for $2,000. There's no evidence Dr. Bob's mortgage is paid off. I went and did a search of the Summit County clerk offices and could find no lien cancellation for 855 Ardmore for 38, 39, or 40. I believe, and this is just an opinion, the first check that went to Dr. Bob was for $500. I think he brought his mortgage up to date, and somehow that morphed into we paid off the mortgage. Okay, my friends from New Mexico and Joyce are going to give out some handouts. As I go through these, obviously these numbers are too small, but these are reprints of the appendixes, and they're going to show all these dollar figures. For almost all of the money, I have two sources, both from Rockefeller Archives and from GSO. But I have primary material backup for any of the monies. Again, the first check that went out to Dr. Bob was for $500. Then they sent money to Elizabeth Mayo, to Fitz M., and to Bill. then Bob, then Bob, then Bill, then some more was pulled out for Riverside. Some went to Hank P. And on in the summary. For those of you who can quickly do math in your heads, we're $50 short of $5,000. If you add that up, it's $4,950. I don't know where that other $50 went. I couldn't find it. And believe me, I looked. So the true story, and it's still just as wonderful a story, is that Strong calls Richardson. Wilson meets with Richardson. A later meeting is held in the boardroom. Frank Amos on his own dime goes to Akron, sort of true. Now here's where relying on memory hurts. These come from different AAWS sources. One is a talk by Bill where he says he was favorably impressed and also noted the similarity to first century Christianity. Or he called Richards and said, somehow I'm strangely stirred by all this. Or, though much impressed, Mr. Rockefeller declined to give any large sum. Or, our friend Dick R. showed Frank's report to Mr. John D. Rockefeller, who at once manifested a great interest. Or, his interest was immediate and lively. There's no question that Strong called Richardson because we have correspondence going back and forth setting up that meeting. Bill sat down with Richardson one-on-one. I have correspondence backing up that meeting. He heard enough, as you saw in that other memo, to schedule a meeting with all the other associates on November 10th and a letter was sent to that effect November of 1937. Sometime in December of 37, they all sit down together. Amos agrees to investigate AA in Akron since he's got to go out there anyway. Takes a 3-day side trip and gives his report back to Richardson. At some point between December and February of 38, he at least mentions AA to Rockefeller. Richardson, in agreement with Amos, Scott, Chipman, and whoever that mysterious number four is, sends a letter to Rockefeller dated February 23rd, 1938, in which he asks for the... Richardson changed the $10,000 request to $5,000 this year, and let's defer a decision until next year on the other five. On March 17th, Rockefeller sends his answer back, says, no, we're just giving five. Don't come back for more. And the money is to be distributed through the Riverside Church. He dashes any hope of continued support with that do not come back for any further money for this object. And Bill and Bob live to sing another day. They get through the winter of 38 and manage to survive. About a year later, in February of 1939, Frank Amos puts together a brief history of Alcoholics Anonymous and tries to arrange another dinner or meeting with Rockefeller. He states, quote, Mr. Richardson and I feel that another evening dinner and meeting should be held soon so that all these matters can be thoroughly discussed and, if possible, a forward program determined upon. Amos proposed that Rockefeller read the attached letters from Bill and from Hank P. and to formulate his ideas so a meeting could be set up. Meeting never takes place and a year goes by. And Rockefeller now suddenly steps forward. He writes a memo. Richardson writes a memo to Rockefeller stating, you kindly talked to Mr. Chipman and me as a plan to provide for the work with the alcoholics. That work is developing, and we've gone along with our part making some progress. If there should be any further interest on your part, will you, at your convenience, let Mr. Chipman and me know? A couple months prior to that, Bill had written a letter stating that Chipman and Richardson and some others of still more importance are planning a dinner to be held in 2 weeks or so with invitations to some of our prominent local capitalists. Obviously, it was a little quick. The letter dated December 4th that Richardson wrote gave a date without mentioning Rockefeller's name of January 17th, 1940. Richardson would tell the trustees that Rockefeller had indicated that he thought the time had come to offer the struggling fellowship encouragement and impetus. Why did Rockefeller change his mind? He also made another pledge of $1,000 for the general fund, and I have no idea why he changed his mind. There's nothing in either archives to indicate why. His usual method of dealing with private charities is he would do some initial funding and then almost take a Darwinian approach and sit back and just see what happened. He very rarely did continuous funding of any enterprise, with the exception of very few. Colonial Williamsburg is one of the few exceptions. So why the renewed interest? A hint to the possible answer can be found in a letter he wrote Russell Colgate of Colgate Palmolive on March 14th, 1940. As I read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I keep saying to myself, why should not this same formula of unselfish service be applied to other realms of human life? And if it were so applied, would it not make religion infinitely more practical and effective? So let's see who's coming to dinner. At the right, and in your handout is a full list of those who were invited and came, and those who were invited and didn't come. It was a raw list I got from the Rockefeller Archives, and I spent a long time figuring out who some of these people were. J.C. Penney is pretty obvious who that was. But some of these people, it took some digging. I found in the Cleveland Public Library there was a Who's Who in Business and Industry in 1941 that was very, very helpful. But there's some hitters here. B.R. Donaldson was the president of Ford, the chairman of the RCA, the president of Bell Telephone Labs, the chairman of the Bank of New York, a governor of the Federal Reserve Bank, the chief judge in New York courts, Wendell Willkie, who rather unsuccessfully ran against Roosevelt for president. So Scott chairs this meeting. Bill is sitting there waiting, looking around the room. Bill knows who all these people are. And he knows how much money they have. And I'm sure the cash register is just going cha-ching. But his bubble's going to burst. Dr. Fosdick tells everyone that they have very small overhead financially, no big organization, nobody making anything out of it, no high-salaried staff, people for the love of it sharing with others. There's strike one. Mr. Rockefeller had laryngitis, so his son Nelson sat in for him. And I can guarantee you this is not Nelson's words. I'm sure that his father told him to say this. Gentlemen, you can see that this is a work of goodwill. Its power lies in the fact that one member carries the good message to the next without any thought of financial income or reward. Therefore, it is our belief that Alcoholics Anonymous should be self-supporting. So far as money is concerned, it needs only our goodwill. Checkbooks go. Strike two. Rockefeller, after the dinner, writes two cover letters and sends out big books. One letter to the people who came to the dinner, one letter to the people who didn't. In a letter, Richardson stated that he reiterated in this letter that he wrote, that he reiterated his high confidence in Alcoholics Anonymous, the satisfaction he had in knowing that many of his friends had witnessed the start of a movement of such great promise, and his deep conviction that our society should be self-supporting. That was strike three. But then the real value of that dinner and the real purpose in Rockefeller's mind of that dinner happened. The next day the papers come out. My favorite is John D. Dines Tosspots. And these are pulled from newspapers from all over the United States. When Rockefeller did something, it was news. The letters start coming back in, and the money starts coming back in. So who donated? And again, this is in your handout, so I'm not going to go through it fast. Blumenthal gave more than Macy's. It's quite a list of people. All told from the dinner, $4,960, including the $1,000 that Rockefeller gave. The true value of the dinner, and this was stated in a Grapevine article, I think written by Bill, I don't remember. At the risk of personal ridicule, he had stood up before the whole world to put in a plug for a tiny society of struggling alcoholics. Wisely sparing of his money, he had given freely of himself. Then and there, John D. Rockefeller saves us from the perils of property management and professionalism. He couldn't have done more. What mattered is that millions of people have now heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and shortly after this, the Alexander article comes out, and we're on the map. Book orders start to pour into the tiny office. Inquiries and pleas for help start to pour into the tiny office. All this is great. We go a year later. They're selling books like crazy. The prospectus from Works Publishing promises that the stockholders are going to get a little piece of every book sold, and nobody has seen a penny. The natives are restless. So at this point, and this is in 1942, a plan was proposed, and at this point in our history, Rockefeller influence is still significant. Out of the 7 trustees and 5 advisory board members, 5 or 42% are Rockefeller associates. Richardson, Amos, Shaw, Chipman, and Scott. Alcoholics members included Horace C., Bert T., Doc Bob, Morgan R., and Bill. So the Rockefeller associates held as much influence as the alcoholics. Rounding out the members were Dr. Strong and a Mrs. Ferrand, who I talked to Michelle about. I have no idea who this lady was. She said she's going to try and find out. Shaw would soon be replaced by Leonard Harrison, also a Rockefeller associate and a member of John D. Rockefeller's liquor study group. So probably what happened is Chipman and most certainly others met with Rockefeller sometime in early 42, and as a result of that meeting, a plan was hatched to raise $8,500. Rockefeller probably followed a common practice of his where he said, go for it, whatever you raise, I'll match. Once the plan was agreed on, Willard Richardson put together a report from the Alcoholic Foundation to help with the fundraising effort. In a document, uses to which a loan of $8,500 to the Alcoholic Foundation would be put, was dated March 16th of 1942. The reason we know that Rockefeller was directly involved is in April 1942, Chipman writes a letter to John D. Rockefeller III. It says, as a result of a discussion I had with your father some weeks ago, I decided to make an effort on behalf of the trustees. Money began to come in almost at once. On April 2nd, Rockefeller sent a memo to Chipman, pledging a loan slash contribution. As Chipman told him, he had already secured a subscription to some $2,000. Rockefeller agreed to a $4,000 loan, but he credited $2 for every dollar paid back. So in effect, it was a $2,000 gift and a $2,000 loan. And that, by the way, is the money that we paid back. It wasn't the initial $5,000. It was this $2,000. At the same time, he pledged another $1,000 for the foundation's general budget. So since his initial pledge of $5,000 back in March of 38, his support had been steadfast. With the exception of 1939, he'd supported the general budget of AA every year with gifts of $1,000 in 40, 41, and 42. With the current $4,000, he contributed $10,000 and loaned $2,000 in 4 years. And again, this isn't Depression money. So what do we owe? 40 stockholders wrote $3,150, Charles Towns $1,600, Agnes M. $1,000, royalties to Dr. Bob $1,190, miscellaneous $500, preferred stock $900 for $8,340. What did we raise? Rockefeller was $4,000, his two sons gave $1,000. And if you look at the ones, the Herbert Pratt, Carlton Sherwood, Charles Noyes, Dr. Riley, they're all people on the dinner list, plus the associates, 90% of the money raised to buy back the big book came from Rockefeller. Do we own the big book today without them? I don't know. It's an impossible question to answer. But there would have been a shareholder revolt soon. This story I just have to tell because it's just so bizarre. His final contributions in AA in New York. In 1946, a situation arises that involved clubs, intergroup offices, property ownership, gift policy, and debt. Again, Rockefeller is closely involved, and once again, his wisdom and foresight would save AA from itself. The situation began innocently enough, as things do in AA. The Manhattan group had lost their meeting place at the New York Cosmopolitan Club. And while looking for a new location, this large group had to break up into smaller groups. There was like 700 members that would meet in one group. Then they found a property at West 48th Street that would enable them to meet in one large group again. Problem was, the property was not available for rent. It was for sale for $300,000. On March 6, 1947, Chipman sends Rockefeller a four-page, single-spaced memo titled Alcoholics Anonymous Movement in New York City and Surrounding Area. What's really interesting about this, at the time, Chipman was the general, it was still the Alcoholic Foundation, but basically the General Service Board treasurer. And here's the treasurer of the New York office interfering in a local matter. Interesting. Or trying to solve it. I'm not sure interfering is the right name, but he's trying to solve a local problem. He says the main work of the New York area is carried on in a church structure belonging to the Reformed Dutch Church. They've been splitting up since December. This splitting into smaller groups had worked well in Cleveland and Los Angeles, but in Minnesota and Chicago, they have not split up. There are advocates for both plans in New York. One central office, however, makes it easier for the travelers. It's one of the ways in which the movement has spread so rapidly. The potential site found at 227 West 48th Street, and the AA has been working on this matter since December. Chipman had talked to Rockefeller prior to this memo, because he says, you will recall I mentioned this to you casually. And Richardson wants Rockefeller to finance the $300,000. They're going to split off the manse. There's two homes on the property. They're going to sell those for $100,000, and Rockefeller's going to fund a $200,000, 3%, 2% amortization mortgage. That's a 50-year mortgage. We are optimistic, if nothing else. So where is this property exactly? Well, that's a map of Manhattan. It's about two blocks from Rockefeller Center. It's right next to the Eugene O'Neill Theater. It's right in the theater district of Manhattan. It's about 3/4 acre. I don't live in New York, but I think that property might be worth a couple of bucks today. So Chipman feels Rockefeller should make the loan, citing the only danger would be if the management got squabbling. Can you imagine a bunch of AAs arguing over money? He concludes, I would therefore hope that this would give this matter very careful consideration. 5 days later, on March 11th, from Jackson Hole, Rockefeller telegraphed his refusal to make the loan. Thank God. Can you imagine what a disaster that plan would have been? All told, Rockefeller directly provided $15,950 to us. $2,000 of that we paid back. Indirectly through his sons and direct associates, another, it totaled $37,455. And depending on how you do inflation, it's about $600,000 today. The Rockefeller family archives contain letters to and from Rockefeller concerning Alcoholics Anonymous up to 1957, and it started in 1937, so it's a 20-year direct involvement. The final contact between AA and the Rockefeller family is a telegram from Nelson congratulating Bill on his 35 years of sobriety in 1969. During all the tumult and growth pains, John D. continued to follow AA's progress with interest. For example, a regional convention was held in 1948 in Toronto. Both Wilson and Chipman attended, and Chipman sent a four-page report to Rockefeller. In July of 49, Leonard Harrison resigned the Board of Trustees over the conference. At the time of his resignation, Rockefeller Associates, Amos Richardson, and Chipman were still involved with the foundation. And one of the questions I asked myself that there's no answer to is, what was in it for them? We talk about the non-alcoholic friends we have and throughout the history of this fellowship, and the dedication and the hundreds of hours and the efforts that these three men, Chipman, Amos, and Richardson, gave to us. What was in it for them? Nothing. They didn't make any money. The trustees weren't paid. There was certainly no prestige in running a bunch of drunks. But we owe them all a great debt of gratitude. As the 50s began, the New York headquarters staff had grown to 6 alcoholics and 14 other employees. And this was the first time that no Rockefeller-associated men would lead the board. About a year after Harrison's resignation, Dr. Bob succumbs to cancer. The late 1950s completed the transition from almost one-man rule to the leadership of the trustees, the conference, and the staff. And miraculously, Bill's depression lifts. Rockefeller Associates would continue to be active with us over the years. Harrison would return to service board chairman from 56 to 61, and Frank Amos remained on the board until 1965. Interestingly, we came to help Chipman in his retirement years. We paid him an honorarium. He wasn't doing very well financially. And once Abby came to need some financial help, Bill recognized what a can of worms this was, and let the Rockefellers know about Chipman's plight, and they took over his support at that point. So this wasn't just 5,000 and a dinner. This was almost 25 years of involvement of these people. He saves Bill and Bob from poverty and obscurity in 1938. He allows his associates, Richardson, Scott, Amos, Chipman, Harrison, and others, to help nurture, lead, and organize AA. Help that lasted almost a quarter of a century into the 1960s. He let some of his people help us form the foundation. He gives a dinner that Bill thought was to raise money, but Rockefeller knew was to raise awareness. He continued his financial support, and with two of his sons provided 55% of the money needed to buy back our basic text. His influence and wisdom was pivotal to the funding, or lack thereof, of that New York clubhouse. His wisdom of saying no helped teach the lesson of the perils of property management and ownership, as well as the danger of mixing the movement and clubhouses. He provided significant help to AA seamen. They had taken over the West 24th Street Clubhouse. It was a unique group of people because they would come to port, get drunk, and be back at sea for years. And he provided almost $3,900 to them over the years. Chipman was very interested in it. And he would write letters, you know, I'm not going to keep making loans if they become gifts, but he just kept supporting them, and I'm not sure why. The founding period of Alcoholics Anonymous carries the fingerprints of Rockefeller everywhere. You know, going through this whole process, especially the time I spent at GSO and Stepping Stones, the law of unintended consequences sort of took effect. I've always known on an intellectual basis the sacrifices these guys made. And what Michelle would give me was, she would give me a folder that was like 1938, and she'd mark the documents that I was looking for, and there would be four or five out of a folder this thick. And the problem is, I wanted to read everything in the folder. And I did start to read some of them. There was a letter that Bob wrote back to Frank Amos that said, thank you for the $200, but why don't we give it to Bill? He needs it more than I do. When he didn't need it more than he did. Bill wrote a letter to Fitz M. in September of 38 when they were totally broke, where he said, "Broke as we are, I insist the goose hangs high." Another 1938 letter detailed how Fitch had liquidated his farm to raise money. Hank had no money. Bill had gone $1,500 into debt to survive. A wonderful letter where Bill is expressing wonder in 1940 that groups are forming from the big book only, and concluding that I guess missionaries aren't needed after all. Many letters detailing Bill's failed attempts to find work. A report to the trustees in 1940 lamenting the fact that Bill and Bob cannot stay away from AA work, but they can't survive financially. And is there some way the trustees could help? They listed the financial sacrifices they had made. Bob had borrowed $2,400 from a relative. Hank was $725 in debt. Bill had borrowed money everywhere. Bob wrote a letter to Richardson in 1940 talking about the need to revive his practice, but to do so would mean abandoning much of the AA work. One of the folders I went through, I found the original foundation agreement. It is sitting in there. And turned it over, I looked at the signatures. And if any of you have ever seen a letter Dr. Bob wrote, his handwriting is indecipherable. Like Michelle alluded to, you've got to sort of turn it sideways to try and figure out what it says. But on this agreement, in fountain pen, in perfect penmanship, says Robert H. Smith. Robert H. S. And I could feel through that paper how important that was to him. And just sat at that table and cried because of the power of it. What became clear, and this is true in every single one of your areas, not just New York, is what these men and women sacrificed and what they went through enabled every one of us to be sitting here today. We're not talking about making enough money to make payments on the Lexus. We're talking about being able to eat. And yet, with all those troubles and trying to barely survive, they always chose to help alcoholics. Always. Our duty as archivists and as archive committees is to make sure that nobody ever forgets what they did. I'm going to give Rockefeller the last word. He writes a letter in 1940 and says, "This is truly an extraordinary movement. One of the things that interests me most about it is that help comes to the helpless drunkard only in proportion as he tries to help another in need. After all, that principle is fundamental in life, but how few of us, even if we recognize it, practice it." Thank you.